Orthodoxy and Heterodoxy with Father Andrew Stephen Damick. Discover how Orthodox Christianity and non-Orthodox doctrine differ and why it matters to your spiritual journey. Father Andrew is the pastor of St. Paul Antiochian Orthodox Church in Emmaus, Pennsylvania. He is also the Associate Director of the Society for Orthodox Christian History in the Americas, as well as one of the founding administrators and editors of the Orthodox Wiki website. Here's Father Andrew.
Okay, now we're going to move on to what on your outline is Roman numeral number 4, denominational families. So now we're going to give a sort of overview of a lot of the denominations that came out of the Radical Reformation. Letter A, Anabaptists. The Anabaptists were so named because of their practice of insisting on believers' baptism, even for those who had been baptized before as infants. Anabaptism means to be baptized again. Scholars disagree about the precise origin of the Anabaptist movements, but they mainly appeared in the 16th century in Northern Europe, especially Germany and the Netherlands, as well as what is now the modern Czech Republic. The Mennonites, named for their founder Menno Simons, who was a former Roman Catholic priest who joined the Anabaptist movement after the death of his pacifist Anabaptist brother. The Mennonites exist in multiple denominations in North America. Among the major denominations of the Radical Reformation, the Mennonites are largely regarded as the most conservative and most closely following the theology of the original Anabaptists. Among other distinctives, Mennonites tend to be pacifists. One of the branches of the Mennonites is the Amish, who exist in several small denominations in the United States. Named for their founder, Jacob Amon, the Amish were originally part of a movement to reform the Mennonite church. The Amish wanted the Mennonites to include the practice of shunning, social avoidance, of those who had been baptized into the church but subsequently left. They also wanted to hold communion more often. Eventually, the Amish tended to withdraw themselves almost entirely from the world at large, based on the biblical call to be separate from the world. The Amish insist on simple living as part of the spiritual life, which usually includes a rejection of most modern technology. Their commitment to the principle of simple living is so strong that there are often dissensions over apparently trivial issues. I went to seminary with a man whose family used to be Amish and became Orthodox, and I asked him, you know, what kinds of things do Amish talk about when they talk theology? He said, they argue about how many buttons on your shirt constitutes vanity. The Amish now exist almost entirely in Canada and the United States, particularly in Pennsylvania and Ohio. And while most speak English, they also speak a dialect of Old German, which is often called Pennsylvania Dutch. For your other etymological lesson for the evening, they were called Pennsylvania Dutch because when they were asked where they were from, they said they were Deutsch, which means German. And people misunderstood. They're not Dutch. They're German. A group similar to the Amish who do not practice the same sort of deliberate separatism are the Hutterites. Hutterites are also committed to simple living, but unlike the Amish, they will often wear vibrant colors. Although they are unlikely to own televisions or most entertainment devices, they do not reject most modern technology like the Amish do. Like the Amish, the Hutterites speak their own dialect of German among themselves and live in communal colonies. The Brethren are represented by numerous denominations both in the United States and abroad. Their theology is conservatively Anabaptist, and they have a number of distinctive practices. When they baptize, they do so by triple immersion, which is what the Orthodox do as well. They also will accompany the reception of communion by a love feast, a common meal, which was a practice in the ancient church that originally was connected with the Eucharist. They also practice a ritual foot washing before receiving communion. In most respects, the Brethren denominations are quite similar to mainstream conservative Protestants. One of the churches I belonged to before I became Orthodox was a Grace Brethren Church. And one of the more profound experiences of my life that eventually led me to start asking questions about the place that ritual has in worship was experiencing a foot washing before communion service. I've never seen this before. It was very moving for me. The Moravians, and if you live here or near Emmaus, you know about the Moravians, or in Bethlehem. They are, as a distinct community, they actually predate even the classical Reformation, having their genesis in the teachings of Jan Hus, a 14th century Roman Catholic reformer in Bohemia and Moravia, who wanted the church to conduct services in the local language, Czech, rather than Latin. He wanted to give the laity communion in both kinds, both the body and the blood. Practice at the time was to give the laity the body only, and to eliminate the teachings on purgatory and indulgences. Hus himself was eventually burned at the stake for heresy. But within about 50 years after his death, his followers organized themselves into a group called the Bohemian Brethren, who operated at first within the Roman Catholic Church. After the Reformation began under Luther in Germany, the Hussites began to interact with Reformation theology and came to be similar to most believers in the Anabaptist movement. The Moravians, quite notably for the Orthodox, do not use the filioque in the Nicene Creed. They both influenced and were influenced by the groups that became the Brethren. In fact, in many ways, Jan Hus was attempting to get back to his Orthodox roots. Letter B, the English dissenters. The Anglican Communion gave birth to several dissenting groups, most notably the Methodists, whom we discussed in the last lecture, who were heavily influenced by Pietism. The Presbyterians, mostly Scottish Calvinists, are also classified as dissenters, but like the Methodists, they were theologically and structurally more closely connected with the classical Reformation. Aside from the Methodists, however, the largest group of dissenters from the English Church were known as Puritans. The Puritans, who flourished in the 16th and 17th centuries, were strongly Calvinist in their theology and urged the English to purify all popery from church life, thus their name, Puritans. The Puritans, like the Methodists who came much later, were essentially pietistic in their basic outlook. Their strong emphasis on personal morality being enforced by public condemnation led in America to the well-known witch trials in 17th century Massachusetts. And it is also memorably depicted in Nathaniel Hawthorne's novel, The Scarlet Letter, in which an adulteress is forced to wear a red letter A in public. Though they were more often known as separatists, Puritanism was the religion of the pilgrims who landed at Plymouth. And it is also the essential cultural element in the modern American fascination with scandal. It is also notable that Puritanism included a powerful work ethic founded on their Calvinistic understanding of the predestination of the elect. It was believed that the elect would be materially successful in this life. And so Puritans and other Calvinists always worked hard out of a desire to prove their election to themselves and others. This sense of being part of the elect is also what led the Puritans to be so confident in their condemnations of those they believed were demonstrably among the damned. This work ethic is examined by the German economist and sociologist Max Weber in his classic work, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, first published in 1905. In a very real sense, it was the Puritan need for assurance of their eternal election which led to the building of America. The Puritans in America themselves suffered schisms. And one of the more significant was the Quakers, officially called the Religious Society of Friends. Nicknamed Quakers because of the physical quaking they exhibited in moments of mysticism, the Quakers believed that each Christian can and should experience God directly. Their mysticism tends to be in group form rather than individually, and typically occurs during meetings. Quaker meetings have no clergy, and members of the meeting speak as the Spirit moves them within the meeting. It is believed that baptism is experienced as an inward reality, and so members do not undergo a physical baptism ritual. Quakers also do not officially hold to sola scriptura, because they believe that the Holy Spirit leads them directly and would never lead them astray in their interpretation of the Bible. Over time, however, this belief led to divisions among Quakers when they disagreed over where God was leading them. Most modern Quakers, however, are not very concerned with theology as a normative set of doctrines and practices. Instead, what they believe is most important is how God leads them in the moment. In this, they are clearly pietistic in their outlook. One group which broke off from the Quakers were the Shakers, who practiced a similar way of life and set of beliefs, although they tended to organize into separatist communes. The Shakers dwindled over time, however, as some members were attracted back into cities for work, and also because official Shaker doctrine taught celibacy for all members. The Shakers began in the middle of the 18th century and attracted up to 200,000 converts over the next 100 years. As of 2006, there were only 4 Shakers left alive, living together in southern Maine. Letter C, Baptists. Among the things that I have been, Baptist is one of them. There are contradicting theories as to the origin of Baptists. They may be either an offshoot of the Anabaptist movement or possibly to have been founded by Puritans. Anabaptists in England were known to have been called Baptists as early as 1569. Whatever the case, the first Baptists as a distinct community appeared sometime in the late 16th or early 17th century. Early Baptists were divided into 2 general camps based on whether they accepted Calvinist or Arminian views on salvation. The particular Baptists were generally Calvinistic, believing that God had a predestined elect set aside from before creation, while the general Baptists were Arminian, believing that the individual believer could choose to be saved. In our own time, Baptists may hold either view or may hold to a sort of hybrid view, in which the believer is responsible for choosing God initially, but then his free will is bound forever after that moment, that he cannot again become unsaved once he is saved. This hybrid view is probably the most common. Baptists who believe that salvation can be gained and then lost again are called free will Baptists. For most Baptists, however, salvation is a one-time event based on making a personal decision for Christ, which, if made sincerely, makes a person saved. Most Baptists hold firmly to sola scriptura, but because every congregation has the right to decide its own doctrine, they do not all agree on what the Bible means. Nevertheless, because they share a common tradition, Baptists tend to share a common set of distinctive doctrines. They strongly believe in the individual believer's responsibility for God, without any reference to the church community. This is called soul competency or soul liberty. They reject sacramental theology regarding baptism and the Lord's Supper as purely symbolic ordinances commanded by Christ, but not contributing in any sense to salvation or having any mystical element. They also believe that the local congregation is the highest authority in church government. If a congregation does belong to a denomination, it is usually understood simply as an association. The denomination holds no direct power over a local congregation. Ordination is usually for men only, but confers no special role. It merely acts as a sort of accreditation of a man's ability to lead, and most especially to preach. The Southern Baptist Conference is the single largest Protestant group in the United States, with about 16 million members and 42,000 churches. There are several other major denominations of Baptists in the United States, such as the General Association of Regular Baptists. Now I want to take things in a slightly different direction with Roman numeral number 5. I'm calling this Case Studies in Ecclesiological Inheritance. Having examined the influences in some of the denominations of the Radical Reformation of the 16th and 17th centuries, let's consider two groups which descend from those influences but adopted contrasting understandings of the basic doctrine at issue in the Radical Reformation, that is, ecclesiology, the theology of the Church. Both of these groups were not properly part of the Radical Reformation, and rather formed in the 18th and 19th centuries as part of the revivalist movements, which we will examine in the next lecture. Nevertheless, both inherited crucial ideas from the radicals and reinterpreted them in their own times, while also standing out in a number of ways from the general spirit of revivalism. Letter A, Adventism. The Adventist churches, the largest of which is the Seventh-day Adventist Church, are descendants of the Millerite movement of the 1840s. The Millerites, like the Radical Reformers, drew followers from across denominational lines, including Baptists, like their leader, William Miller, Presbyterians, Methodists, and members of the Restorationist churches. Miller was a Baptist preacher from Lowhampton, New York, and he calculated that Jesus Christ would return to earth on October 22, 1844. The Millerites had a handful of doctrines which made them distinct from their various denominational affiliations, but what united them was the common belief in the truth of Miller's calculation, which he claimed to have derived from prophetic passages in the book of Daniel. Because Miller shared the radicals' belief in a rejection of tradition and church authority, he believed that his method for reading the Bible was beyond question. October 22, 1844, came and went, however, and there was no clear indication that Jesus had returned to earth. This came to be known as the Great Disappointment. And most Millerites disbanded and returned to their various churches. Some, however, believed that Miller's calculations were correct, but that his reading of Daniel was flawed. Instead of Christ returning to earth, he entered into an inner sanctuary in heaven, signaling the beginning of an investigative judgment of professed believers. Some believed that the October date in 1844 marked a shut door, after which no true conversions to Christ would occur, although that has since been rejected, particularly since there is no one left alive now who converted before 1844. You can see where that would become an unpopular doctrine. It is out of this reorganized group of Millerites that the present-day Adventist churches were formed. They still believe that the second coming is imminent, although they no longer set specific dates. One of the Adventist groups in particular believes that Christian worship should follow the Jewish pattern, and so they worship on Saturdays and are called Seventh-day Adventists, who are the largest of the Adventist denominations. It should be noted that not all Adventists share identical theology. There are various kinds. Besides the belief in the investigative judgment and observance of Saturday as the Christian holy day, some of the peculiar doctrines of Seventh-day Adventists include soul sleep, which means that the human soul sleeps unconsciously between physical death and the final judgment. And also conditional immortality, that is, the wicked do not suffer eternally in the afterlife, but are completely annihilated. Adventists are also traditionally teetotalers, rejecting alcohol and tobacco use. They also encourage vegetarianism and avoidance of caffeine. That's why I could never be an Adventist. I like meat, I love coffee. Many mainstream Protestants regard these emphases as legalistic. Seventh-day Adventist ecclesiology teaches that a remnant of true believers will be saved in the end. The true church is therefore spread throughout all the world and probably across many denominations. Seventh-day Adventists entirely accept the invisible church ecclesiology of the Radical Reformation, that the true church is ultimately invisible. They also believe, however, that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is the true visible church, as elucidated in the writings of early 20th century Adventist Ellen G. White, who's regarded as a prophet by many Adventists. As such, Adventist ecclesiology represents something of a refinement of radical Reformation ecclesiology. In this modern age of theological relativism, Adventists are often regarded as exclusivist because of their belief that the Seventh-day Adventist Church is the visible church. Seventh-day Adventists, like most Sabbatarians, who are those who believe in Saturday worship rather than Sunday, mark the great apostasy to about the year 135 A.D. St. Justin Martyr's description of Sunday worship in the year 160 is looked upon as evidence for this apostasy from the true faith. Restorationism, let it be. Restorationism came out of the revivalist movements in the late 18th and early 19th century in the United States, following the teachings of the leaders Barton W. Stone and Thomas and Alexander Campbell. It was therefore also known as the Stone-Campbellite movement. The central idea of the restorationist movement was that there is only one church, and that all Christian churches are somehow part of it. Nevertheless, restorationists believe in the great apostasy, although they would chart it as occurring over many centuries rather than shortly after the death of the apostles. Restorationists ultimately believe that they are working toward the renewal and restoration of the New Testament church, and that the traditional creeds of historic Christianity only serve to divide rather than unite believers. Ironically, restorationism itself is divided, however. It is represented by several denominations, the largest of which are the Disciples of Christ and the Churches of Christ. Interestingly, like the Orthodox, the Churches of Christ regard themselves as being identical with the New Testament church, and that all other Christian groups represent a schism from themselves. Despite this belief, however, there is no apostolic succession to back it up. And the belief in the great apostasy would seem to be a contradiction as well. How can the Churches of Christ be the original New Testament church if that New Testament church completely fell away at some point in history? The only possible way to reconcile these beliefs is to believe that the church has somehow been reincarnated or resurrected after its death. Ecclesiology for restorationists is primarily understood in terms of organization rather than theology. Unity is a major theme for restorationists, and this is to be accomplished through a common set of doctrines and practices, but without any sort of hierarchy or denomination beyond the local congregation. Without the context of an episcopacy or denomination, it is easy to see why restorationism itself split fairly early on and remains divided. What was supposed to unite all Christians together divided even those in the movement. Restorationists do have a number of things in common with the Orthodox, however, such as the belief in the necessity of baptism, although they do not baptize infants or believe that baptism accomplishes something in itself. They also hold communion frequently, although without a belief in the real presence. And in many cases, they practice only a cappella music in church. In fact, the question of whether or not to use instruments in church was the cause of a schism within the restorationist churches. So you have the one Churches of Christ that are called the non-instrumental Churches of Christ, and another Churches of Christ are called the instrumental Churches of Christ. Despite these similarities, however, restorationists generally hold to a view of the Bible in which silence is regarded as prohibition. Thus, many do not use instruments in music because they do not see them in the New Testament. In other words, if it's not in the New Testament, you're not allowed to do it. They also do not see what the Orthodox see in the New Testament, namely an ordained sacramental clergy. Thus, while they do usually have a paid pastor, he's not called by any title and is not believed to have any special ministry different from anyone else in the congregation. Congregations do have elders and deacons, but they are administrative roles and have no special theological significance. Finally, the most significant criticism that Orthodoxy has for the Restorationist movement is the same it has with all the children and grandchildren of the Radical Reformation. If the true church was really lost at some point, how can you know that your version of it is a true restoration? Falling back on sola scriptura does not solve this problem, since all the descendants of the Reformation divided into hundreds of denominations and tens of thousands of independent congregations, all claim to be simply teaching the Bible. There are three major restorationist denominations or groupings in the United States: the Christian Church Disciples of Christ, the Churches of Christ Non-Instrumental, and the Churches of Christ Instrumental. And there's even one I remember seeing when I lived in North Carolina. It was near my house, and the sign out front said Church of Christ, and then in parentheses underneath it, it said Christian. And I thought, as opposed to what, the Church of Christ is Buddhist, or I don't know. But that was just a curious combination of labels on that sign. You know, it's been interesting that in recent years, a number of non-Orthodox churches has started gaining an interest in Orthodoxy. But not in terms of Orthodoxy as the church, but rather as, oh, that's neat. Why don't we try that? And I mean, now, that's a little bit crass way of putting it, but I think they intended sincerely. So, but, you know, part of it comes out of pietism, right? Which says it's really about your private relationship with God. And so if you find some element of spirituality that works for you, then go ahead and adopt it. It doesn't matter. Go ahead and adopt it. You know, and so one of the things that's occurring, we're going to talk about this, so don't get me started on it now. We will talk about this. There's a group of churches that are calling themselves emerging churches, or the emergent churches. And they are known for this extreme hodgepodge approach to spirituality. And so sometimes you'll go into one of them and you'll be seeing elements of the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. Or you might go in and see what would appear to be some sort of multimedia extravaganza. You know, and they'll sometimes mix the two things together, or three or usually 10 different things that they're mixing together, sort of looking for something. And it's clear to me that this evinces a hunger that is there. I believe it's really there. You know, in the last 50 years especially, some of the churches that have seen the biggest growth are the liturgical churches. They really have. You know, and it's the biggest growth in Christianity in the United States, especially in the last 20 years, has been on the extreme ends of the spectrum of sort of low church and high church. The liturgical churches, on the one hand, are gaining lots of people, and then the Pentecostals, on the other hand, are gaining lots of people. It's the sort of normal middle that is now being deserted. The mainline churches, like most of the ones here in this town, in Emmaus, most of the churches here in Emmaus are mainline churches. They're watching their attendance just go through the basement. They're just dropping and dropping and dropping. You know, like the Episcopal Church in the U.S., as an example, they, while they're busily talking and splitting and splitting and splitting, you know, their attendance keeps going further and further and further down. A lot of their churches have really big endowments, so eventually you're going to have these wonderfully maintained buildings with no one in them. I think there is a real hunger for solid spirituality, something you can touch and taste. Okay, let's draw some conclusions. The Radical Reformation, in most respects, was simply an expansion on the theological presuppositions of the Classical Reformation. With the doctrine of sola scriptura firmly in place and informed by the anti-authoritarian streak which characterized the radicals, the division into numerous factions and movements, all with different theology and practices, proceeded rapidly. Rapidly. More than anything else, the acceptance of the doctrine of the great apostasy led to an almost perpetual insistence from each new group that it had at last discovered or restored the true New Testament church. Like the reformers before them, the radicals understood themselves not as innovating in doctrine or in practice. Rather, they believed that they were returning Christians to ancient, pure, primitive Christianity. But without either tradition or hierarchy to guide them, their movements quickly split into a multitude of divisions, all claiming to have the corner on truth, but without any historical or traditional evidence to authenticate their claims, most especially because of the rejection of apostolic succession. The radicals could give their followers no assurance that their doctrines were true. All common ground was based almost solely on mental agreement over how the Bible was to be read. Almost every time there was a disagreement led by a charismatic theologian, a new denomination was formed. At its heart, the Radical Reformation is a rejection of the Incarnation. Let me explain why. Most of the radicals would, of course, adhere conceptually to the traditional dogmas about the Son of God becoming a man. But their theology and practice fails to reflect all the implications of the Incarnation. For the Orthodox, because God became a physical, material man, the Church has a concrete, historical reality. Ordination also requires a physical act of laying on hands. The Eucharist has a physical component to its spiritual reality. The physical act of baptism really accomplishes something spiritual. Icons are a witness to the Incarnation and an integral part of church life. All of these material elements in the ongoing salvation life of the Christian are rejected by the radicals. And so we can only conclude that their theology of the Incarnation is lacking something at its heart. What was rejected in the Radical Reformation was the physical side of being spiritual. There is much that the Orthodox have in common with various sectors of the Radical Reformation, most especially the insistence that the individual believer is accountable to God for his own salvation. But Orthodoxy sees and practices that accountability within the community of the Church, not as a separate sort of contract that the Christian has with God, which is ultimately independent from any community. Further, Orthodoxy shares the Pietists' emphasis on living a life of devotion to God and his moral teachings. But at the same time, we believe that such a life is only possible if formed by the saving dogmas God has revealed to the Church through the apostles. I believe that there is much hope today, however. Many of those who are coming to the Orthodox faith are coming precisely from the churches whose inheritance is from the Radical Reformation. I believe that there is only so long that faith can be mainly a mental and emotional activity. We all must eventually reach out to the God who truly can be touched.
That was Orthodoxy and Heterodoxy with Father Andrew Stephen Damick. Father Andrew is the pastor of St. Paul Antiochian Orthodox Church in Emmaus, Pennsylvania, and the associate director of the Society for Orthodox Christian History in the Americas. This has been a presentation of Ancient Faith Radio on the web at ancientfaith.com.